Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard, not the billiards. It was
billiards room.
Come on already. Come on, we call it the
The place to be.
The place to be, yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Isn't that what I just said? What is wrong with you?
Is it the Pelicans? I didn't know it was the Pelicans.
Oh,
I
like,
nothing
like,
about the Pelicans.
Yes,
I worked during the fucking day, okay?
And so then I'm doing this, and then he touches me, and I swear to God, this is going to sound, this is probably one of those you want to pull out the audio for your promo. He touches me with his voodoo stick.
Until you fancy to make a decision, Scott's stuck twisting in the wind, a pawn in your sick, cruel game of vacation domination. I don't know what the fuck the Department of Health is. I think this whole thing's a load of horseshit, Matt.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here, nigga. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here, nigga. Always tell stories about the man. Say I never struggled, wasn't hungry, yeah, I doubt it, nigga. I could turn your boy into the man. Ain't really much out here that's popping off without us, nigga. We just want the credit where it's due. I'ma worry about me.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and it feels like it's been forever and a day since we've been coming to you live here from the PTB Man Cave Studios. So let me waste no time in bringing in my one and only, my PIC, back from traveling the country in his RV, picking up chicks. That's my my main man, Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
JR, it's a pleasure to be back. Trolling the mountains of northern Pennsylvania. The weather was very cold, but it was nice to actually come back from a vacation and realize I didn't miss any good wrestling.
No, yeah, definitely not.
Apparently the shows last week were fairly awful.
Yeah, you took a good week to not have to write all the shows.
Yeah, exactly. And this week it seems like the only live show, for once TNA is the lucky week, because they only have one live show. They're the one live show this week on Thursday, because of course Raw tonight is of course taped from earlier today in London. Well, you'll, of course, see that blog later on. But, JR, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. I missed you this week.
No,
I missed being on the air with everybody. I did. I missed being on the air.
It was a good you planned your vacation well, whether you meant it or not. But the fact that we needed a break after that weekend. And that podcast Wednesday, you know, remember when J.J. Dillon told us he was exhausted after that podcast he did with us? That's how I felt. Just trying to remember everything from that weekend and still just coming down from that high. Of WrestleMania and everything that went with it. It was a lot, and it was good to kind of take that week off to refresh and regroup, and we got our schedule lined up, and
yep.
We got a nice little treat in our email box last week while you were away, and we did a little finagling of the schedule, and that's because instead of the planned Vintage Vault we had for tonight, we had to jigger things around a little bit, and we have a special guest with us tonight, Scott, and this is one we're really looking forward to.
Yes, very much so. By the way, of course, it is episode 214, of the Place to Be Podcast, and tonight we are going to have another great guest. I mean, we always talk about the great guests we've had, and you mentioned one, of course, JR, and that is J.J. Dillon. We've had Stevie Richards, Eddie Edwards, Bruno Lauer, Scott Hudson. Of course, we always have Kevin Kelly on. We've had some awesome guests, but tonight is a special one because this might be, next to Eddie, I believe, and of course, John, your man there, Mr. John Walters / R.J. Brewer, but this might be our first actual active wrestler and in a big time promotion.
Yeah, of the big two for sure.
Yeah, the big two. He has had a very distinguished career, and he's been in the business longer than people think, as I was kind of currying through his career today.
Nice choice of words there.
Yes, I know, exactly. This guy has been in all three promotions. Actually, technically, he's been in all five promotions of the last, in some capacity. He's been in WWE. He's been in WCW. He's been in ECW. He's been in Ring of Honor. And, of course, he is a huge star. And he's one of the stalwarts, if you will,
yes,
of TNA. And, of course, he has got a high-profile spot in TNA now. He is one half of the team Bad Influence with Kaz, Frankie Kazarian. He's a former X-Division champion, an extensive resume. He's won titles in Ring of Honor. He's got an interesting career, and he's had as I was going through his stuff today, JR, he actually has done something I don't think anybody else has ever done in the history of the business. He has been the head of two heel factions in two promotions at the same time. That's unprecedented.
Yeah, very impressive.
We'll talk about that with him tonight. We are, of course, talking about a.k.a. the Fallen Angel, a.k.a. the Curry Man. He is Christopher Daniels.
And Scott, after that awesome introduction, I think there's nothing else left to do but to bring the man himself in, the Fallen Angel, Mr. Christopher Daniels. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a very awesome introduction. It was very par. It was almost as if I was being walked to the ring at WrestleMania right then and there. So thank you.
It was almost like you were the old King Haku and Scott was just carrying you down to the ring on the cart.
Yes, I felt it.
All right, Chris, so we wanted to mix things up a little bit. We'll do some career stories and other road stories, but we also, we know you're good, just a wrestling fan, a comic fan. We're just going to bullshit here tonight. We'll have a good time. We'll spend some time together, and then we have some listener questions as well that we can get to.
Okay. I have no fear of spreading bullshit, so let us go.
Awesome. You'll fit right in here then. All right, sure. Scott, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So obviously the first question, Chris, that we'll ask from the beginning. Obviously you were a comic junkie as a kid, so we'll get to that later. But when did you first like wrestling? Were you a fan as a kid? And B, when did you realize you actually wanted to get in the business? Like, first, when did you become a fan? Who were your early favorites?
Okay.
And B, when did you decide this was what you wanted to do?
Okay. Well, I grew up in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is where Fort Bragg is. I wasn't a military brat, but that just happened to be where I grew up, and that was Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling territory. So I grew up watching guys like Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes. I was there, not live, but I mean, I watched the formation of the Four Horsemen. I watched Ricky and Robert, the Rock and Roll Express, against the Russians, the Midnight Express, and Jim Cornette. So, like, I grew up as a fan. I want to say, my memory is bad in terms of numerically, but I want to say I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And I remember the stuff I started actually following was right around the third Starrcade, which was when the Four Horsemen had just sort of started. They broke Dusty's ankle. He had to wear that wacky white boot that was reinforced. And they sort of, I want to say, if my recollection is real vague, but I want to say Dusty kicked Rick in the head with the loaded boot. He won the belt, and then they reversed the decision after the fact. But that was my earliest recollections were, Four Horsemen, Starrcade, Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, which ended up becoming part of the NWA, or was always part of the NWA, which is why Ric Flair was part of it. And then that sort of slowly but surely, as the territories passed away, it became a hotbed of WCW. So I grew up watching those guys. My first favorite wrestler was Magnum TA. And, I got to watch him wrestle live many times, a couple against Ric Flair, a couple times against Nikita Koloff. And then once he had his accident, my next big favorite was Sting, ironically enough. I think I saw them when they became the Blade Runners. I thought, what a great idea for a tag name coming from the movie, in the same vein as the Road Warriors, obviously, but just slightly different. And I never got to see them tag as the Blade Runners. But once UWF was bought by the NWA or WCW or whatever, you started seeing the UWF guys coming into the NWA, and that was where I first got to see Sting, and thought, this guy stands out. There's plenty of wrestlers, there's plenty of muscle guys, but this guy had the makeup and the look, and it was different, and that he became a favorite of mine as well. I went to college, graduated college with a theater degree, and moved to Chicago with the lady that I ended up marrying. And we were doing children's theater up there. And I was sort of struggling. I got out of college. I tried to do children's theater, and that was the only stuff that was actually paying. So I wasn't really paying my bills as an actor. And I told her in sort of passing, sort of tongue in cheek, like, ah, you know, if this stuff doesn't work out, I could always be a pro wrestler. And she got, you know, she's got a wild hair up her and started looking for wrestling schools and found a school. We actually lived on the outskirts of Chicago. She found a school in Chicago called Windy City Pro Wrestling, and she made me an appointment to meet the man who ran it. His name was Sam DeCero. And so I went in and I met with him, and she says that when I came out, I had this look in my eyes like I was starstruck, like I you know, hypnotized, mesmerized, whatever. And so at that point in time, this is the end of 1992. And having said this too, I had sort of fallen away from wrestling, watching wrestling as much as I did from the time I was a senior in high school through college and the year or two after college. So I wasn't as prevalent in terms of watching wrestling as I was back then. So end of 1992, I have the meeting. The acting career wasn't going great. And I decided, you know what, I'll give this a shot. And if I go into the school and I fall apart and I wash out and I'm no good, at least I could tell my kids, hey, I tried pro wrestling. So I took a loan to my mom co-signed a loan for me to go into the school. I started in January of 93, started training. And because I was such a fan, I had a pretty good frame of reference in terms of like, okay, this is a body slam. I know what a body slam looks like. It looks like this. And so it was very easy for me to sort of pick up the how-to part of professional wrestling, which is really easy. I mean, you can train anybody to do the moves we do. And the more on that, so it doesn't sound like I'm just burying my own job. But, you know, I learned that part of it very quickly. So in January, I started training. By April, I started wrestling my matches, and the third match I ever wrestled, I won my first championship. And once I started wrestling and performing in front of live crowds, that was where I started learning actually the things that wrestlers need to know, which isn't how to do stuff, but when to do stuff and why to do stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there are guys that know how to do 1,000 moves and, you know, they're acrobatic or athletic or whatever. But they just don't know how to tell a story. And that's what I learned. And that's what I still learn today. I think that is the job of the professional wrestler. Once he knows how to do things, to go and do it in front of live crowds and learn how to tell stories and how to get people involved and connect with them emotionally and entertain and, you know how to do stuff, when to do stuff and why to do stuff.
Now, is there anyone that you watched growing up or as you were getting into the business, that you, I don't say, just took traits from, or anyone that you tried to really emulate?
If yeah. I want to emulate, absolutely. Because and there's a timing story in terms of this as well. Remember, as I'm growing up in the, you know, the '80s, the late '80s, you know, the guys were the Road Warriors and Nikita Koloff and Dusty Rhodes, and those guys are like 280. You know, and I always use the Road Warriors as the example that they were, you know, 6'5 and 260 or 280, and Lex Luger was this and Sting was this, and I was never going to be that, and I knew that. I mean, that was one of the reasons when you ask me when did I want to get in the business, I don't say that I always dreamed of being a pro wrestler. I mean, I dreamed of being a pro wrestler in the way that people dream of being an astronaut. Oh, wouldn't it be cool if the next day I woke up and I was an astronaut? Well, yeah, that would be cool, but I didn't think I could be a pro wrestler because I didn't think I was ever going to be Road Warrior Hawk or Nikita Koloff. Now, having said that, beginning of the 90s, you get guys like Shawn Michaels, you get guys like Sean Waltman, and I was watching Global Wrestling Federation on ESPN,
yes.
And he was 200 pounds. Shawn Michaels was 220, and he was less than 6 feet. You know, the tallest I've ever been was 5'11". And so that was when I saw guys and thought, okay, maybe there is something in this for me. And so when I went to meet with Sam DeCero at Windy City Pro Wrestling, he had an idea that the business was going to change in terms of the types of people that are going to start coming through his doors to be trained as wrestlers. And so he was one of the first guys, and this is 92 when I met him. He said, all right, well, this is our situation here. We welcome all types of bodies. If you're 6'5 and 320 pounds of solid muscle, outstanding. I was 5'11 and 180 pounds. Still, welcome, Christopher Daniels. But here's the deal. We have like weight classes in our professional wrestling school. We have heavyweight, we have middleweight, and we have lightweight, and you would fit perfectly in the lightweight. And so when I told you I won my first championship I ever won was the Windy City lightweight heavy, the lightweight time championship. And so he knew that not, you know, and this was, you know, obviously this is the time when the steroid scandals were yep. sort of high on the deal. So he knew that it was going to be very few and far between where you're going to get a Lex Luger walking in the door going, oh, I'd like to be a wrestler. You know what I mean? He knew that there were going to be skinny kids, skinnier kids. I don't want to make it sound like I was, you know, frail. But, you know, I played sports as a kid, but not – I wasn't a football player. I played soccer. So I wasn't slight, but I certainly wasn't, you know, I wasn't John Cena walking through the door. And, you know, when I decided – that I wanted to be a professional wrestler. I decided like in October, and I knew I wasn't going to start until January. And so like in October, I started hitting the gym like regularly. And the first thing I knew was, all right, well, I got to get my stamina up. I knew I was going to have to get my cardio up. And so I, you know, and this is me, this is the first time I ever got into a gym seriously, not knowing, okay, well, this is what I need to do to work out. I just started doing as much cardio as I could, thinking, all right, well, I got to be able to get in there and run and hit ropes and do this stuff. And so, so the guys I emulated were guys like Shawn Michaels, Shawn Waltman, the guys that were lighter weight, the guys that basically, as I was growing up or getting back into wrestling, was watching basically the Intercontinental Champions, because those were the guys that were wrestling and going and, you know, they'd wrestle 20 minutes at a time, 30 minutes at a time. And I was like, okay, that's something I think I can do. And so that's what, you know, when I started training, that was sort of my goal, was to get to be Shawn Michaels.
And it definitely sounds like it was a good time for you to break in, because those are the guys that were really starting to make the waves and get bigger pushes around that era. Now, I do need to ask you your memories of Global, because as most of our listeners know, I'm a big Global fan. We had Scott Hudson on, and I was basically gushing on him being an announcer for Global. Do you have any memories watching it growing up? Anyone specific?
Not so much. I mean, I knew the Patriot. That was my first introduction to guys like the Patriot. Yeah. Obviously, Shawn Waltman, Buff Bagwell as the Handsome Stranger, mm-hmm. You know, Booker T, you know, God, they weren't called Harlem Heat then, though. They were called
Ebony Express,
something yeah. to that, or Ebony Experience.
Yes, Ebony Experience, I think you're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it was a great time, too, as a fan to get into cable, because, like, at first, all I was getting was NWA, and that, to me, was the wrestling. And then as cable became prevalent, I started watching Tuesday Night Titans, and that, to me, was a bit more of a song and dance.
Yep.
You know, you're watching, you know, Tuesday Night Titans and the nighttime talk show aspect of it. And you're getting guys like, you know, sometimes you get the stars, but sometimes you get Rusty Brooks, who is, you know, Jobber to the Stars. And, you know, they do little skits, and that sort of colored the type of wrestling that I wanted to be too, because I wasn't a big fan of like the cartoony rock and wrestling connection of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Ric Flair wrestle for 30 minutes. That to me was great. Watching Magnum TA and him go at it, watching Dusty and Ron Garvin and Tully Blanchard and these guys wrestling, that to me was wrestling. And so that colored my, I guess the, it colored my views of what I wanted to do as a wrestler when I got older. And then that sort of fed into my appreciation of Shawn Waltman and Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and Kurt Hennig and the guys that were the Intercontinental Champions of the time, or the U.S. Champions, Ricky Steamboat. You know, that sort of stuff, you know, once I was in my 20s and debating doing this wacky business that I'm in now. Going back to Global, I'm sorry. you would also, you know, my point being that with the cable, the advent of cable, I was getting World Class, I was getting AWA, I was getting Mid-South, and I was getting Global. And you would see, that was where you're seeing different types of, you know, different styles, different types. And I got a chance to see guys like, you know, like I said, you know, Buff Bagwell as mm-hmm. the Masked Stranger and Sean and, the Patriot for their very first time. But to me, global and world class were very similar to that in that respect. I don't want to say that, like, one, I didn't think one was any, like, head and shoulders superior over the other. It, to me, it felt like the same flavor, because I knew there was, you know, they were both out of Texas, and I felt like, okay, well, this is sort of similar, different guys, but the same sort of vein, you know, that hard hitting, that sportatorium feel. And so, yeah, they were all good memories to me. I have better recollections of world class just because I was more week to week. I was following that more week to week. The global stuff I didn't always get,
right,
in terms of like week by week. I would get like, I would see it one week, and then they would have either world class or AWA in that slot, and then I'd see global again, and I was like, oh, okay, well, here's Chaz Taylor and things like that. So, you know what I mean?
Now, Chris, you were in many promotions. You hopped around a little bit in the early 90s. You were in the Empire Wrestling Federation. You went down to Puerto Rico and wrestled for Carlos Colon in WWC. The indie circuit didn't seem to really kick in, become prevalent to a lot of people till after ECW closed, the early 2000s, Ring of Honor. But before we get to that era, what was it like in the indies in the 90s? When there were these three big promotions and there was a lot of TV for that, when you were in these smaller promotions, what was it like in the early 90s with some of these smaller promotions? Were they run differently than they are now? Or how was it in the early, when you first started, in terms of the way these promotions were run, in terms of management, things like that?
Well, you know, it's funny too that you would say in the 90s, because I don't really feel like my independent career really started until like 98. Mm-hmm. So I really got the tail end of the indies. You know, and when I say that, I mean, like, I didn't have any success outside of the very small radius of my home until, like, the middle of 98. Like, I was doing local stuff. Like, I moved to California in 96. Okay, 93, from 93 to 96, I was in Windy City. I stayed in Chicago. And I did very little stuff other than that tenure in WWC in Puerto Rico. But I was just doing Chicago stuff. And there, at that point, there wasn't a whole lot. And because of the mentality of the schools that I worked with, it was, well, if you work for us, you can't work for this guy. So I didn't do a whole lot. There wasn't a large variety of stuff I was doing. Then I moved to California in 96, and I literally thought that I was going to have to quit, because I had never heard of any stuff out in California that had any legs or any sort of spotlight on it. And I came out here and found out about Empire Wrestling Federation, and then through guys I met there, I learned about local Lucha Libre stuff. You know, so like I was doing a little bit of here, a little bit of there. And I ended up, so anyway, to your question in terms of like how things were run back then, everybody, it was like everybody was an island unto themselves. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of, working together. I mean, I didn't realize how professionally run Windy City was. As a student, I didn't realize how well they ran their shows and how well they ran their schools until I came out to California and met other schools and other guys. And, you know, and then I appreciated it. You know, you don't know how good or how bad you are in terms of your school until you go to another school and you're like, whoa, these guys are way better than I was, or whoa, this place is rotten. And so like I came out to California and, you know, some of the things, like, for example, I was always trained, get gear, don't wrestle in street clothes, because you don't want to look like you just stepped out of the third row. So like I, you know, as low budget as my gear was, it was spandex, it was wrestling boots, it was knee pads. I came out to California and guys were wrestling in overalls and street shoes and baggy pants. And I thought, whoa. And that to me said something that the guys that were training them weren't saying, hey guys, look like a pro. They were saying, do whatever you can to get in the ring, which I respect too, because there were guys that knew how to make that work for them. And there were guys that looked like they were just being lazy. So I don't want to like throw everybody under the same blanket of, oh, you weren't professional. You know, there were guys like the Raven era where Raven, you know, and mm-hmm. You know, Raven wrestled in, you know, the t-shirts and the jean shorts. There was a period of time where people were like, oh, Raven's doing it, why not me? And right. My answer to that is, you're not Raven. Yeah. You know, Raven made it work. There were guys out here that had, gimmicks that worked for them in terms of wearing street clothes. Not everybody could do it. And not everybody understood that they couldn't do it. So I understood. Like, I could look at somebody and go, all right, well, you're a street thug from L.A., so you're wrestling in that gear. I'll buy that. All right, you're a white kid from, you know, the middle of the suburbs. Why are you dressed like this? You know, and at that point, too, I didn't feel comfortable enough in being – it wasn't like I was a veteran. I was, like, 4 years in at this point. So I wasn't somebody that was, like, pulling guys aside going, look here, guys, in my many years, yeah. I feel it's best. You know, I just took notes, and I was like, all right, well, this guy's got it. This guy understands it. This guy doesn't. And this is how I get off conversation again, because I've completely – okay, running independent companies. Same thing.
That answer is better than my question anyway. So
I didn't understand how well our shows were run either until I got to places where things were sort of like, all right, well, we're just sort of we're flying by the seat of our pants. And I'll tell you a perfect story. I was always trained the main event is the main event, and everything underneath is not the main event. I go to – the first show I ever did out here in California was Empire Wrestling Federation. I was wrestling a gentleman by the name of Bulldog Sampson, probably fifth match. In the opener, there was a young gentleman. I will not name his name, but anyone who knows me knows this story, and so they'll laugh. And you don't need to know his name to laugh. But anyway, the opening match, the first 90 seconds of the match, wrestling. One guy goes to the floor. The bad guy goes to the floor. The babyface climbs to the top rope and attempts to do a moonsault to the young man. And instead of moonsaulting to his opponent, he moonsaults to the top of his skull to the floor. Oh, thud! And the record skips, the DJ skips, the brakes hit, oh, the world stops. And I watch this and I'm like, what the hell just happened? This guy in the opening match decides to do a moonsault to the floor. Decides to do a moonsault to the floor. B, isn't good enough to do it and almost kills himself. So everything. And I'm like, who told this guy that it was okay to do something like that in the opening match of a show? And that was a discipline thing, you know. At our place, our guy, Sam DeCero, when they were running shows, you know, matches would go to him. All right, well, you guys are the opener. Just go out there, do some basic, you know, good action, but I don't want to see any wacky high flying, maybe a crossbody, but everything else, you're on the mat, simple stuff. Go out there, tell a good story, make it short. Don't try and steal the show. And everybody built towards the main event. And then I got here and realized, all right, well, nobody's telling these guys that. They're just like, okay, you're wrestling this guy, go. And I understood, all right, well, there's a discipline to knowing where your spot is on the card and playing to that and trying to build the show rather than make the show about yourself. So.
And it's amazing how simple the philosophy can be when you just follow along, right?
Yeah, but it's tough, too, because it's funny how, like, you think you know a mindset or a strategy or, you know, what you think is right about professional wrestling. And every once in a while, and even to this day, I'll talk to somebody who articulates it in such a way that it makes me step back and go, oh, I never thought of it in that way. And then I'll give you another example of that. Joey Mercury, Joey Matthews, who mm-hmm. is Joey Mercury, mm-hmm. You know, I've known him for a very long time, and we've never really gotten a chance to, like, work together in terms of long-term. Like, we've wrestled each other, we've shared locker rooms, but we never were in the same company for a very long time. But one night, he and myself and AJ Styles were talking, and he was just, I don't know how it came up, but he literally just said, the reason that heels are booed is because they take things away from the fans that the fans want to see. Heels get heat by depriving the fans of what they want. And that, to me, it was like such a gem of knowledge. But no one had ever really articulated it to me in that sense before. And this was like, you know, I had been wrestling nine years at that point, maybe, but no one had ever said to me, heels get heat because they take things away from the baby faces, the heels or the fans. The fans want to see the baby faces do this and the heels won't let them. Boo heels. And that to me was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I've always kept that in mind ever since I got that. But I mean, my point, going back to the point, sometimes no one will articulate what you're trying to learn. You know what I mean? No one really articulates why you do these things. You know, sometimes it's just because they were trained to do that. And I've always been of the mentality, like, if you don't know why you're doing something, if I'm doing something in a wrestling match and at the end of the match, I go to the back and someone says, why did you do that? If my answer is, I don't know, it was wrong. I do for a reason. Mm-hmm. And it may not be a great reason, and it may not be a reason that translates to the crowd. And in that sense, then it's my fault because I need to articulate what I'm trying to get across better. But me as a wrestler, me as a storyteller, everything I do in that ring, I'm doing for a reason.
Do you think a lot of that comes from your theater background as well?
That too. I think the thing with the theater background that helped me in terms of that, like, I don't consider myself Daniel Day-Lewis by any stretch of the imagination. I wish I could say I was a great actor. I'm okay. But I think that the thing that theater taught me to do is learn to play to everybody. You know, when you're in theater, they tell you to project because you have to have the guys in the back row hear your voice. Mm-hmm. Same thing with wrestling. And this is when I do seminars. I tell guys, you need to play up and out because not everybody's in the front row. And you need to tell this story to everybody in the building. And if the person in the back row understands what you're doing as well as the guy in the front row, then you're telling a good story. You're articulating your story in a good fashion. So yeah, that helped me. I learned how to play up. I learned how to play out. And then once I got to do television, I learned to play to the cameras and understand that the people behind the cameras were my real audience. The fans that were in the arena were a portion, but they weren't the priority. The camera was the priority. So that helped. That theater background taught me that.
So a couple questions, one kind of back of where we were and then one kind of conceptual one. But going back, what was it like going to Puerto Rico that young, that early into your career? Was it a radical, you know, change in atmosphere? What was the fans like? It just for someone kind of wide-eyed going into that atmosphere for the first time.
It was okay. It was very scary and multiplied by the fact of the way it got called. Like, we got called, myself and Kevin Quinn, who was my first tag team partner, one of my best friends from professional wrestling. We trained together in Windy City. Mm-hmm. We were going down as a tag team, and this is exactly how it happened. They called us on a Monday, and they said, we need you down here by Friday, and you're going to be here for probably 6 months. And I was like, what? What? Wow. You know, and I had just gotten married. You know, I was literally probably 18 months married at that point. A little bit more than 2 years married at that point. Mm-hmm. I had never been away from my wife for more than 2 days at that point, you know. And same thing with Kevin, his long-term girlfriend. So literally we're on the plane and we're both like teary-eyed, like, holy shit, we're leaving. You know, and it hit us hard, man. And we didn't know what was going down. We had no idea. But one of the guys that helped, I don't want to say helped train me, but helped teach me in terms of, like, he was one of the first guys that started me thinking when to do stuff, why to do stuff, how to tell stories. His name was Mike Moran. He was one of the Texas Hangmen. He ended up becoming one of the guys from Disorderly Conduct and WCW.
Okay, yep.
And mm-hmm. literally one of the best minds in terms of tag team wrestling and professional wrestling that I ever met. He was great. And, you know, I owe a lot of my success to the way he made me think about professional wrestling. So I can't say enough good stuff about Mike Moran. But he was the guy, like, something happened with the tag team that was down there. It was actually Sean Morley, who was Val Venus, and his mm-hmm. partner, Shane Sewell. They were the Canadian Glamour Boys. Shane had to leave and go back to Canada. And so they were the tag champs at the time. So because that happened out of nowhere, hey, we need another tag team. Mike Moran said, I know a tag team. Give them a call. Call us on Monday. Get down here on Friday. So we got down there, and Kevin and I met with Invader Number One, who was the booker. His name is Jose Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. And they literally threw us right in the deep end. They were like, all right, here's the program. We're going to do a tournament for the tag belts. You guys are going to lose in the first round. But when Invader and Hurricane Castillo win the belts at the end of the night, you guys kick the shit out of them at the end. And here we go. And okay. So we wrestled. We got DQ'd in the first round. We put the boots to the boys at the end of the night. And every this was when you would shoot television on Wednesday. You would wrestle Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And that was my first job in wrestling. And that was when I was like, oh crap, I'm a wrestler. I'm not Johnny Weekend. I'm wrestling for a living right now. And it was crap money. We were only getting paid $500 a week, but they took $100 a week out of that to pay for our apartment where we lived. So literally we were making chump change, and I was trying to send money home to my wife. We were scraping it. And I'll tell you another thing. This was when locker rooms were completely segregated. So this wasn't a situation where we would get together and, hey, what do you want to do out there? This was a situation where the referees came back and forth and said, all right, this is the finish. You're going to do this, you're going to do this, and then you win. And the rest of it, you called in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
That was invaluable to me. You train a certain way and you get guys, and you're like, all right, we're going to do this and this and this and this and this. And this taught me to call it on the fly, and this taught me to tell stories on the fly. And the thing about calling it on the fly, it's sort of a misnomer, because I always knew what I wanted to do in the ring. I just didn't get a chance to tell that guy until I wanted to do it. So like when I say call it on the fly, I just mean like communicating it to the guy on the fly.
Right.
That was where that taught me how to do that. And that gave me the confidence to do it. So, and it was great, man. I can't say enough about how much fun it was to go down there. I got a chance to wrestle with Sean Morley, with Invader number one, with Hurricane Castillo. Meeting Carlos Colon was such an honor, because, you know, I knew who Carlos Colon was. I'd never seen WWC, but I knew who he was, and the fact that he brought me down and appreciated my talents and I had such a good relationship with him. I got a chance to meet Gorgeous George, Jungle Jim Steele, Rex King, those guys, working with those guys. And then Mike Moran came down as Kodiak the Bear and got to hang with him. That was where I first met Dutch Mantel. So that to me was such a great experience.
And I think that's, the way you learn down there, I think it's a lesson just in any career or any line of work, is sometimes just getting thrown into the fire and being forced to teach yourself and to learn on the fly and observe others. Sometimes that's the best way to do things. I think it's a good life lesson.
Yeah, and it's tough, man. I mean, and it forced me too, because I tell guys all the time, the only way you're going to become a commodity as a professional wrestler is if you can get comfortable enough with yourself that you can walk into a locker room, meet a guy for the first time, and 3 hours later wrestle a good match with him.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with that is so many guys get trained in a spot, and they wrestle in that same spot, and they wrestle the same guys, and they become as good as the best guy in that locker room is. And if they never get a chance to branch out and test how good or how comfortable they can make themselves in a wrestling ring, they stagnate. And so going and doing that, to me, made me think, okay, I can do this for a living. You know, and it's funny too, when I came back, we only lasted 6 weeks, to my eternal chagrin, only because my wife called me one day and she says, look, I'm going to have to get a second job because you're not sending enough money home. And now the insurance that you had from the job you had when you left, that's being canceled. And so I can't afford anything and I have to get a second job. And I was like, okay, that's not fair. I can't do that to her. So I put my notice in, we left. We left on good terms, mm-hmm. but we just said, look, sir, we can't afford to be here. If it was just me, if I wasn't married, I'd have stayed there. You know what I mean? But I had someone else to answer to, Soda. And so I was only there for a little bit of time. When I came back, I thought, okay, I'm a professional wrestler. I was in Puerto Rico. I thought doors would open for me. That didn't happen either. I came back and I just got back to wrestling in Windy City and doing Windy City and Chicago Independence. And that wasn't the big break that got me on the road. So there was that too, that sort of, okay, well, not every break is going to be a big break. Sometimes a break is just a break, and you work, and when that job is over, you go back to being where you were. So that was another wake up call that I got from professional wrestling.
Kind of fast forwarding back to where you're in California now. At that time, wrestling's obviously blowing up, 98, 99, promotions popping up everywhere, TV ratings through the roof. Do you think, in the long run, it hurt more than it helped? I mean, at the time, obviously, it was great. So many guys had jobs, and there was so much competition. But do you think that rush to just throw out a promotion in every local town and TV market and the push for these ratings, do you think in the end that really did more damage to the sport of wrestling than it helped?
It's possible. I mean, you can easily say that there was an oversaturation, like you couldn't turn around without seeing professional wrestling. But I think part of that was not all of it was good professional wrestling. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if there's a lot of good stuff and there's a lot of good compelling television or a lot of good compelling wrestling going on, there's room for it. I mean, you know, there was a period of time when it was, you know, WCW and ECW and WWF, but it was all compelling. And, you know, you look at the Monday night, the height of the Monday Night Wars, there was a lot of good stuff happening. You know, it wasn't until some of it started to fail in terms of quality that then it was like, oh, there's a lot of crap, you know. In terms of the independent scene, I think that there were a lot of guys that said, okay, here's a successful market, I want to jump in, without really knowing how to maximize and build. Like, they were just in it for the short sale. All right, let's run a show. Okay, yay, this did great. You know, there are very few companies that started or lasted or, you know, had longevity. And I'll tell you one specifically. Jim Kettner was running ECWA on the East Coast out of Delaware. The place where the Super 8 tournament was, he had run since 1967 as a promoter. He knew what audience he was playing to. He knew how to get the best out of his wrestlers. He knew how to promote his shows. And that was why his company lasted so long. And there wasn't enough Jim Kettners in the independent wrestling scene. And that is a shame, because Jim knew what he was doing. He had a good eye for talent. He knew how to hide weaknesses and feature strengths from everybody he had on the card. He knew how to build a card. He knew that the opening match was supposed to be the opening match, and the main event was the main event, and ne'er the twain shall meet, all that stuff. And I think if there were more guys like him that put the effort, the due diligence into learning the craft and learning how to tell stories, not just as a wrestler, because he did wrestle, but I mean, as a promoter, as a storyteller, as a guy who had a vision of what he wanted to show his wrestling fans. If there were more guys like that and less guys that were just, all right, you wrestle him, you wrestle him, you wrestle him, I'll go count the tickets. You know, if there was less of that and more Jim Kettner, I think that, you know, it would have been better for professional wrestling overall.
Now, as JR mentioned, you know, as we got to the late 90s and things changed and the wrestling got blown up, many indie promotions, and of course the big three were burgeoning, you got your tryout in the WWF 1998, right as the wheelhouse was starting to really turn.
Yes and no. But go ahead, continue your question.
No, please. Expand on that. I was just going to ask, how were they taking the growing promotions around them, and what were your remindings and your thoughts on when you were there for that time?
Well, I will tell you this: I never once had a match where they said to me, "This is your tryout. If you do well here, you will have a job." It was never like that. I never once had that. Mm-hmm. What happened for me was, And it's not a weird situation, but my mentality at the very beginning of wrestling in 93, I got the mentality that I didn't want to go and be on WWE television to be like an enhancement guy, because my thought, and this was told to me by a couple of guys in our locker room in Windy City and around, they said, if you get on television and you make the impression as an enhancement guy, you'll never be more than an enhancement guy. And that scared me. I was like, God, I don't want to go on and be a jobber for the rest of my life. I want to be, you know, I want to be Shawn Michaels. I want to be the Intercontinental Champion. How am I going to do that if all I ever do is get beat on television? So I stayed away from doing that for the longest time. Somewhere along the way, once I got to California, I thought, you know what? Never mind. I want to get my name out there. I want to do this. I will let the chips fall where they may, whatever. So, Victor Quiñones, who was a Puerto Rican promoter and a very good friend of Kevin Quinn, who was my partner. He had a relationship with the WWE in terms of the when they did that that short period of time where they had the luchadors there. Of course, in addition to the luchadors, they started the light heavyweight division and Taka Michinoku came in. Because Victor knew Kevin so well, Kevin introduced me and Victor knew me and knew that I was a good wrestler. I was going to go out. I did a couple of dark matches with a guy named Mick Tierney out of California. And they were very interested in Mick Tierney, WWE. They didn't give me two looks at that point. And Mick Tierney was someone that, you know, he was built like, he was like Dolph Ziggler, but about 30 pounds heavier, like tall, muscular. And, you know, he was Irish. He had a good look. So I went there to be, you know, basically his tackling dummy and, you know, put him over in belt form and blah, blah, blah. So the WWF guys knew who I was, but they didn't know that I could do anything because, you know, in those matches, you know, I would get a couple little flashes of offense, but then he'd pick me up and throw me around like a rag doll. Anyway, Victor Quiñones, finally, I went to do a TV taping in Phoenix. And Victor Quiñones said, "Hey, look, I want you to wrestle Taka tonight. I know you can have a good match with him, and I think they want him to have a good match. They want to see what he can do." And, you know, at that point, he was wrestling guys like Brian Christopher and, you know, guys that didn't necessarily lend themselves well to a Japanese style or a light heavyweight style. They were like smaller guys that just wrestled like they were bigger guys. Mm-hmm. And so Victor was like, "Can you wrestle Taka?" And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me because Taka was very giving to me. Like, he didn't look at me and like, "All right, kid, I got to eat you up." He knew that if we went out there and he let me get some stuff on him and then I let him get him stuff on me, it would be a good match and he was going to win anyway. And it made the match better. So I went out there and had the first match I ever had on WWF television, which was the Shotgun Saturday Night. And that opened two sets of doors. Well, three sets of doors for me. The first thing it did for me was it got me overseas. There were promoters in England that saw that match on television and they brought me over and I did some stuff in England and Ireland because of it. Second, it opened doors for me on the East Coast in terms of the independent scene because Jim Kettner saw those matches and that was where he contacted me very soon after that to be a part of the Super 8, which did a lot for me on the West Coast or the East Coast independent scene, which is where the independent scene was basically heaviest and strongest, the Northeast. And then the third thing it did, because I worked with Taka, it got me on the radar of the Japanese promotions, and it wasn't long after that that I did my first tour of Michinoku Pro. So, like, all that stuff sort of happened within the space of 6 to 8 months. Hmm. And, you know, and I was very fortunate that Victor gave me that opportunity and that Taka was so generous and that the WWE let it all happen that way. And, you know, that was one of the first times that I saw Jim Cornette saw my work, and he, you know, he appreciated my talent and he appreciated what I brought to the table. And he always was someone that worked hard to try and get me a spot somewhere. He actually invited me to one of the dojos in the WWF when they were doing it at Titan Towers. I did a dojo that Dory Funk Jr. trained us all. And like the names of the guys in my, this is stuff like, you hear stories about how Adam Copeland and Christian and, who else? Val Venus, guys that went through the dojos or went through the camps. This was a camp, and my camp was Kurt Angle, Steve Williams, Test, Steve Corino, Devin Storm, Sean Stasiak, Tiger Ali Singh, Glenn Kulka. There was a lot of talent in that crew. Hmm. And I got a chance to work with a lot of those guys. That's where I met Kurt Angle for the first time. I got to work with Dory Funk Jr. I got to meet with Tom Pritchard. And, you know, it was a week. It was literally 10 days of work. We went, we did the NWA 50th anniversary show, and then we worked for a week, and then we did a couple matches for some Killer Kowalski was one of the promoters of the shows that we did. I got to wrestle Test on that show and had a really good match with him, despite the fact that our size difference was so, you know, glaring. You know, Andrew, I went to Andrew and I said, look, I think we could do this if you treat me like an equal, at least, and not like someone you can throw around. And he was very cool. He said, okay, well, let's do this. And I, you know, we put together a good match, a big man, little man match, and it went very well. And so, you know, all that stuff sort of happened because of that match with Taka, and I was very fortunate.
I think those camps are kind of lost artifacts of that time. We had Kevin on one of the times we had him on recently. We were kind of going through those camps, like on Wikipedia or whatever, and just amazing the talent that came out of those things, those dojos.
Yeah, I'm certainly not giving it enough credit. The guys that came through there, mm-hmm. I always use Adam and Christian, you know, Edge and Christian as guys, because those guys were going through it, and I got to see them do like dark matches after they went through it. So they're first in my mind, and obviously Kurt as well is first in my mind. But there were so many good guys that went through those things, you know, that got their first shots. I wish they would do that. Well, I guess they're sort of doing that. Hold on.
Yeah, no problem.
Anyway, sorry.
No problem.
I guess they're sort of doing that now as far as NXT. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it was such a good – like, to me, it felt like a good little stepping stone between doing independence. Sort of, you got there, you sort of learned how they wanted to do stuff, and then you – you went on the road and you were doing dark matches with the guys that were on the roster. And that, I think, is such a great learning experience as well. And they still do that, I guess. You know, I wish TNA did that more often, where we would do dark matches and the guys that we want to train and the guys we want to build up, get them on the road and sort of get that mentality going. But
I was always kind of a treat of going to like the live shows, Raw, SmackDown. You always wonder what local guys are going to pop up in the dark matches.
I had a lot of fun doing that stuff. I got a chance to wrestle, like doing dark matches in that respect. I got a chance to wrestle Jeff Hardy for the first time and Ron Killings. And, you know, I did a match with Draws once. I did a bunch of matches with Kai and Tai and some other things. So, yeah, it was very cool. The short periods of time that I got to do WWF and WWE stuff.
So now before we get over to Japan, just quickly tell us about your brief, but of course, excellent run as one of Los Conquistadors in the feud between the Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian.
Ask this.
I have to ask this. So,
of course,
iconic.
It's funny because the first day they did that gimmick was somewhere here in California, and so they needed guys that were of comparable size, which is funny too because Christian is probably 4 inches taller than me, and he may even say more than that, but. That was me and Hardcore Kid Aaron Aguilera, and you know, I think it was supposed to be a one shot deal, and then they called us up and they said, okay, well, you guys are flying to Detroit. Okay, guys, you guys have to go to this. So we did. I want to say we did 3 or 4 different tape things for them, traveling with them and doing the stuff. And you know, the deal was, you know, they brought us in. They would have us do the spots where we would be the Conquistadors on camera with Edge and Christian. And then also we would wrestle dark matches. So, like, Aaron and I wrestled each other in a dark match. I remember one night we were supposed to tag against the Mean Street Posse. But because the, you know, they were running long and they didn't get a chance to tape our stuff until the last minute. And so that got scratched. Yeah, that was a good time, man. I mean, it was a lot of fun and you know, I got a chance to sort of make my face around, like the guys in the locker room sort of got to know who I was for a short period of time, even though it was fleeting. You know, I met a lot of guys and got a chance to travel and you know, live that lifestyle for a little bit.
You also, tried out or had a few matches in WCW closer to the end. In 2000, early 2001, was your philosophy the same as it was? This is two-prong question. First, was the philosophy the same when you tried out there as when you tried out in WWF? The whole "I'm here to make a mark. I don't want to be just a enhancement for somebody higher. I want to be higher." And number two, when you got there in 2000 and stayed through early 01, were you getting the feeling, even as a as someone who's who had been there a short period of time, that that the writing was on the wall in WCW, that they weren't going to be around too much longer?
Not really. I'll tell you, I'm not sure if you know this part of this, but because I think a lot of people look at what happened with me in terms of the Nitro match with Mike Modest. They think that was the only time I was with WCW, when the truth of the matter was the year before I was under contract with them for about 7-8 months. Mm-hmm. But what happened was I had a tryout. I had a tryout, a dark match in Los Angeles with a kid named Mikey Henderson. And I got offered a job right after that by Kevin Sullivan. And I was doing Michinoku Pro at the time. I had one more tour to do. I said, Kevin, let me please finish this tour, and then as soon as I'm done, I'm all yours. And so this was, I want to say, April of 2000. Mm-hmm. So I start the tour. While I'm overseas, I read on the internet that Kevin Sullivan has been fired from WCW. Now the people that are in charge are Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff. And if you know your WCW history, yes, if you remember the night that they were in Denver, the night that the show basically hit the restart button and they gave the belts to everybody.
Yep.
That was going to be my first night. That was going to be my first night under Kevin Sullivan's regime. I was going to debut a character called Syndrome, I think. And they were going to bring me in and do this thing. That fell apart because Vince Russo didn't know who I was. Eric Bischoff didn't know who I was. But I got back and I called and I said, hey, am I fired? And they go, no. You didn't sign a contract with Kevin Sullivan. You signed a contract with us. So no, you're still under contract. And so I got back, but I didn't have any plans. Like they didn't have any plans for me at that point. And so I went in, and finally they said, okay, well, Vince Russo wants to talk to you. He has some ideas. And I go, okay. So I actually went in, and this was the night that they were in Atlanta where Vince wrestled Ric Flair and all the blood fell on him in the cage match. And so I was there in Atlanta and watched the whole show, and I was waiting to talk to Vince Russo literally all night long, all night. And this was the nights, these were the nights when after they would do Nitro, they would do like the web show, like the online web show. And so Vince got out of the ring, got cleaned up, went, was doing that, doing stuff. And Jeremy Borash and Bob Ryder were doing the after shows or whatnot. And I was sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, Vince Russo pulls me aside. He says, Chris, come here. And I go, you know, thinking, all right, man, he's got an idea. He's got something for me. What's he got? And he looks at me and he goes, okay, man, tell me your ideas. And I go, oh, boy. Oh, boy. So okay, and undaunted, I said, okay, well, this is what I do now. I'm the fallen angel. My idea is that I'm, I'm a guy with a God complex. I'm a guy who thinks he's God. I'm a guy who, you know, sort of plays religion into his gimmick and blah, blah, blah. And he heard that and he's like, okay, blah, blah, blah. And then he had an idea where I was going to be affiliated with Vampiro. And they wanted me to sort of be the emperor to Vampiro's Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a skit of me in a robe with this robe covering my head. And I'm sitting in this big metal throne that ended up being the demon's throne. And we did a skit with Vampiro. And, I was like, there are souls that need to be harvested, blah, blah, blah. And Vampiro... he was in the middle of his feud with Sting. And so I cut that deal and we taped it earlier in the day. I remember being in the locker room later, and this is playing live. And I'm in the locker room in the back, and there's a bunch of guys watching the monitor. And my thing comes up, and, it goes on. And at the end of it, Jeff Jarrett's standing there. He looks around and goes, who the hell was that? And I just sort of raised my hand like, that was me. And needless to say, that was the last of that part. They did not like it. And I traveled with them another like 3 months, and every week I would be like, okay, is there anything for me? Nope, not yet. Just, stay patient. So I was traveling. I was going to Nitro every week, and nothing was happening. Nothing is happening. And finally JJ Dillon called me one day. He goes, for the amount of work you're doing here, we're paying you too much. So we're going to have to let you go. And I didn't have the mentality at that point of, wait, give me a chance. I mean, I said, please give me a chance. You guys haven't given me a chance to earn my job or lose my job.
Right.
And he goes, well, I understand that, Chris, but you know, we're where we're at. We got to make some cuts, and you know, we're paying you. I wasn't making a developmental salary. I was making a salary. I was doing good money at that point, but for nothing. Like literally, I was traveling and not wrestling, and they were paying me, and they were like, why are we doing this? We got to stop. And, you know, and I wish, like, one of my big regrets is that I didn't offer to do like a developmental deal with them and say, well, just cut my pay and let me stay on and let me prove that I can do this. I felt like there was no argument that I could make that would change their mind. And so I was like, okay, yes, sir. I will do my best to again, something else. And, you know, so I got let go, I want to say August of 2000. And then I got the opportunity to come back in January, and that was when I had the match with Mike Modest on Nitro and got hired again, this time a developmental deal. But if you remember, at the end of that match, Scott Steiner broke both our legs, and we were off-selling that injury when WWF bought WCW, and I was one of the many contracts that did not get turned over to WWF. So,
do you think WCW could have made it if say Bischoff stepped in and bought it or any of the other rumors, or do you think it was just destined for that just to be scooped
no,
up?
I think the thing that happened was TBS and TNT had a change of heart in terms of like what they wanted on television. And that was the thing that was keeping it alive.
Mm-hmm.
Like if Bischoff had bought it and they still lost television, then Bischoff would have sold it.
Yeah.
Because the TV was the crown jewel in that respect. And once the people that got in power at TBS or at Turner Broadcasting said, oh, this wrestling's ridiculous. Why are we doing this? Let's not. That was the death blow.
How much do you think it hurt North America wrestling? I mean, I know a great deal, but I mean, do you really think it was just a major blow to guys like yourself just looking for that extra job? I mean, how much did it really sting when it closed up and ECW followed right after it?
It bothered me. I mean, the truth of the matter was I was more disappointed that I didn't get the opportunity. Like I didn't realize this till after the fact, but I always had the mentality that all I had to do is get the job. Once I get the job, I got the job. Once I get the job, I've got it. And the truth was that 6 months where I worked for them, then I realized I had to keep the job, and that was a different job. And I didn't know that until I was almost on my way out. And so I was disappointed when I got that second contract. I was ready to go. And I was like, all right, guys, whenever you want me to come back from this injury that I'm supposed to be selling, let me know. And I'm ready to go. And, you know, 3 months later, all right, you know, we don't exist anymore. So WWF, it's up to them. And, you know, I called and I was like, hey, guys, I'm one of those people. And do you have any interest in me? Not at this moment, but just keep working hard and keep in touch. And I was like, ugh. So, yeah, that was bumming. But, I mean, also, though, you know, I got the opportunity to go back to Japan. And I was still very, very busy on the independent scene. So, I mean, I was disappointed, but I had other thing going on. It wasn't like because of that I sat at home for 6 months. So I was very fortunate. I tried not to burn bridges when I got signed. I was very, you know, thank you very much, guys. You know, I hope to work with you guys again at some point, and not knowing that I would be doing so pretty soon. So
you talked about Japan. Very simple question. The birth of Curry Man.
Yes.
How did it start?
Okay. Well, I went over and did one tour as myself for Michinoku Pro. It was a 10-day tour, and they liked my work. And every 4 years, Michinoku Pro did a thing called the Maskman Tournament. It was basically a huge round-robin tournament for Maskmen. And so some of the Maskmen were established characters like Tiger Mask and Great Sasuke and, you know, Gran Aniwa and some of the Mexicans like Dos Caras was in it. And then some of them were characters that were created specifically for the tournament. And so at the end of my tour as myself, they said to me, all right, we want you to come back as this character. And I said, what character? And the guy that was telling me didn't know English very well. So he goes, there's something with food on your head. And I was like, what? Okay. So I had no idea. So I left to go home. I came back at the beginning of that tournament, and they look at me and they go, "You are Karema." And I go, "What's Karema?" I this is just them saying it. So I had no idea what they were saying. I just said, "Okay, I'm Karema." So then I get to the building and I see the posters and it says Curry Man. And I go, "Oh, I'm Curry Man. Great." So they hand me the mask, they hand me the outfit. And I was supposed to be from India. And I was just like, "Is this a joke? What is this? I'm not sure what this is." And so, like, for the first like 4 or 5 matches, I wrestled like I thought I was Apu from The Simpsons. Like, I would hit somebody and that would be like, "Oh, so sorry, so sorry." And, I had no frame of reference for the character. Like, the character was based on a cartoon character there called Curry Cook. And, you know, the gimmick was he had the food on the top of his head. And I don't even know what the cartoon was about. But they told me, "Okay, this on your head, it's a plate. It's a plate of food and rice. And you're Curry Man." And I go, okay. And so for the first week, I had no idea how to wrestle it. And finally, Gran Hamada says, "Just wrestle, man. Don't worry about a character. Just wrestle." And so for 2 or 3 tours, somehow I got, I don't want to say somehow, but I mean, out of the characters that were created for that tournament, I was the most popular. And, they just respected my wrestling and they knew I could go. And Sasuke was very high on my talent. So he pushed me to the semifinals of that tournament and I got to wrestle Dos Caras. And they said, "Okay, well, you're coming back as Curry Man. You're coming back as Curry Man." And, somewhere along the way, I just decided, you know what? Screw it. I'm under a hood. I'm going to have fun. And so I changed the outfit. Like, it was like a Sabu singlet and a pair of like baggy yellow pants. And I changed it, man. I just turned into like, I basically got the short shorts and the cutoff t-shirt. Like, I was Billy Gunn. And I decided to wear the hat and start dancing to the ring. And I wrote the words "eat me" in Japanese on my arm. And I just started having fun with it. I said, screw it. I'm going to, I'm not going to be serious with this character if I'm going to have a plate of food on my head. The hell with it. And so I started having fun, and that was when I had the most success. That was when I think Curryman got more over with the Michinoku crowd than even Sasuke and Jinsei, the guy who was Akushi, and it was his idea of that whole character. I think that was when it became more popular than they even thought it was going to get. And so I had a pretty good run doing it with that and working with guys like Shima, because I joined with the Toramon guys as Super Curry Max. And, that was it, man. It was a great time. And I had a lot of, I had the opportunity to wrestle a lot of great wrestlers and have fun and, just go out there and be wacky. And I think that was the first time that I ever sort of let go of that. I'm a serious wrestler. I'm, like Bret Hart. The wrestling is the thing. I let go of that and was just like, "Hey guys, I'm dancing to the ring. Look at this," and people got with it. And it's something that to this day, I have to remember, it's not just wrestling, it's entertaining, and if you're not doing both, you're failing at both.
You mentioned Hakushi, a guy that, Scott and I both have discussed in the past and kind of feel like it came into North America just a little too soon before that style was really appreciated here. Do you agree? Do you think someone that deserved more of an outlet here in North America?
I thought he had a good run when he had it. I'm surprised he never had another run. And knowing his wrestling and I wrestled him probably more than anybody else in that company as Curry Man, because I was sort of bigger than a lot of the junior guys, and I could, I was strong enough to wrestle with him where if I picked him up, it didn't look wacky. It didn't look like he was helping too much. So, and he liked working with me, so I was very fortunate. I was just I don't know, man. I think he had a great look, and I think that's what the WWF wanted at that time, was that look.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he wrestled more to their style than the style that you would envision Japanese wrestlers wrestling. You know what I mean? So I think that's why it worked for him there. I wish that he had gotten more of an opportunity to go back. But I think he became very involved in the business side of it. And so to go away from that, to go back to the U.S. would have been something that would have been detrimental to his career. Like, when I was working with him there, he was one of the guys behind the scenes that, was sort of driving the creative bus for Michinoku as a company. And so, yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know if he was ahead of his time in that respect, because like I said, it wasn't like, I don't look at him in the same way that like people look at like Kobashi and go, oh, this guy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like he was good, but this is not a negative statement towards his talent at all. I just don't think that's the style he was. I think he looked good. He did his stuff well. He played a character very well. And I think that's what, ingratiated him to the WWE crowd. And I'm just surprised it didn't last longer. You know what I mean?
Okay, Chris, we're going to give you the book.
Oh, Jesus.
You're going to be in charge. Ready for this?
Book Scott's sure. Fantasy match with Triple H for us.
Yes. If you weren't... No, I'm like, no, God, no. No, even better. It's April 2001, and you're in the offices in Titan Towers, and they tell you, book the invasion. How would you have done it?
Oh, God.
You're in charge. Carte blanche.
I honestly have no idea, man. It felt like they had a – I think basically the mentality just would have been let's get down to the bottom of the barrel for us before we fight back. The best invasion angles were always the ones where it seemed like the good guys were on their last legs before there was a fight back. And it just seemed like the WWF never, or like they never wanted to show weakness to the invaders. You know, they gave them a little bit, but it always seemed like they got it back right away. And this is coming from like my memory, which is horrible. So I mean, I could be talking completely out the side of my neck, but I know that there were periods of time where the guys that were coming in the WWF or the WCW guys, and sometimes because of things that they did, I don't know the entire history, but I mean, it was like, all right, well, show these guys how it's really done, and they would get beat up and. You know, you sort of expose them as not being the threat that you want them to be right away. And then what have you got? So I'm not really good in that respect. I'm good in terms of like long-term storyline are not my thing. I'm pretty good in terms of like putting finishes together and telling stories one story at a time, but I've never been good. And I wish I had this talent of telling that long-term story and sort of building. Every once in a while, I get inspirations, but I mean, it really is like with my own character. Like I wrote a couple different ideas of stories of how I could get into the WWF and how I could interact with people. And then once I was established, be there, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I sent those in and those fell on deaf ears. So
it's almost like
I'm not the book of guy you wanted. I'm not the book of guy you wanted.
Scott's gonna fire you. No, we it's also like they went too far the other way. Like with WCW and the NWO, WCW never won anything. NWO just destroyed them until it got old and people didn't care as much.
See, there's a point where if you're gonna get beat down, all of a sudden the fans are gonna get with the guys that are beating ass.
Right, exactly, and that's what happened there.
They're gonna follow a winner after a while, unless they're being so dastardly evil. But I mean, they never were. They were the cool guys, like Kevin Nash and Scott. They were cool.
Yep.
And then when they talked crap, it wasn't like, oh, that was a rotten thing to say. It was, that was funny. Got you. You know, so.
All right. So heading into 2002, you jumped over to Ring of Honor. Of course, yep. Just getting off the ground, the first major show. You were part of the main event. How did you get involved with them? What were your thoughts heading in? Did you see this as something you thought was viable from the beginning, or is it something you want to see? Where okay,
I had no idea. It's funny, like when we talk about TNA and talk about Ring of Honor and being there, sort of at the beginning, you didn't know that something was going on until like a year later, and you're like, "Oh, this is going on." You know, like that first show, I knew there was a lot of talent, but I was just like, "Okay, this is a show," and it's funny because that weekend that I did the Ring of Honor show, I had a Friday booking somewhere in the Northeast. I had that Saturday show for Ring of Honor, which was the first show. And then I flew with a bunch of guys. And that next day I did the WWA pay-per-view from Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I literally wrestled that match that, you know, Ring of Honor fans say still is one of the best you know, in the company's history. I wrestled that match, and the next day I was doing another match, and I didn't think anything of it in that respect. I just thought, okay, that went really well. Yay, thank you, Low Key. Thank you, Brian Danielson. But now I'm in Vegas, and I'm wrestling AJ Styles and Nova and Sharkboy and Tony Marmaluke and Low Key in a six-way at a pay-per-view in Vegas. So, yeah, it didn't occur to me until, you know, a couple months in that I saw Gabe Sapolsky. He had that vision in the same way like I was telling you about Jim Kettner earlier. Gabe had a vision, and he had a vision of the opener. He had a vision of the main event. He had a vision of everything in between. And he had that long-term storyline where he wanted all of this to build somewhere. And I didn't see that until, oh, wow, we're doing this. Okay, it's happening. It's happening around me. It's happening with me in it. So I didn't know, but I mean, if I had had the opportunity to spend more time with Gabe and sort of pick his brain like that, he always told me, this is what we want. This is what I see you being. You're going to be the guy that sort of flies in the face of the gist of the company. You're going to be like that fly in the ointment, and that's what I want you to be. And he wanted me to be the only real heel, like the real bad guy, even though there were guys that were sort of, you know, they used nefarious ways. I was the guy that was spitting in the face of honor at that point. So I was supposed to be the bad guy. So, and that was great, man. I felt very honored, and I don't think I appreciated it then the way I do now, looking at the way the first couple, like that first year of Ring of Honor was.
You mentioned WWA. That's another very eclectic group that kind of was put together. And I remember watching those shows, and I think at the time, you know, everything was popping up. You're just starved for another, after kind of a year of just WWF, I think people were just starved for another major promotion to take off at some point.
Right.
When you looked at those, did you see anything there, or did you see that just kind of another guy taking a shot that wasn't going to last?
Well, those people that were doing the WWA ended up being the guys that did TNA, so I didn't know that at the time either. But, you know, I knew Bob Ryder and Jeremy Barash were involved with that, and those were the guys that got me involved with it, and they were the guys that got me involved with TNA. Mm-hmm. And Bob Ryder was actually the guy that helped me get my second WCW contract after a discussion with Eric Bischoff that he had. He was very instrumental in that. So Bob was someone that was very instrumental in helping me get with TNA and stay with TNA.
The one guy that we don't, Scott and I really haven't talked about much about this podcast, but you had some interactions with early on in Ring of Honor, is a guy that we actually WrestleMania weekend ran into on the streets of New York, and that is Xavier.
Oh, right.
Yeah, one of our part of our group, Chad, actually spotted him and noticed who he was, and we started talking to him. What are your thoughts about Xavier? I feel like he's kind of lost in the history of Ring of Honor. He kind of gets overlooked as a stalwart in those early days. Any memories of wrestling him or competing with him?
Yeah, I liked working with him. I think that a lot of people felt like with all that talent that was in that company that he was an odd choice to be champion when he was. But I thought that was sort of the point. Like, there are times when a championship is going to make a competitor, and there are times when a competitor will make a championship. And at this point, like, Xavier wasn't really anybody of note until he became Ring of Honor champion. I mean, he was talented, but I mean, he hadn't really made his mark on wrestling. And then he became Ring of Honor world champion. And that was the point. Like, Gabe saw an opportunity to build Xavier by putting the championship on him, having him beat Low Key. And so like that was the whole point. And I felt like, you know, there was some good opportunities for him, and I thought he did very well with what he had when he was there.
Hmm. You joined a stable called The Prophecy.
Right.
And at the same time in TNA, when you started, you were in a stable called Triple X.
Right.
I find that amazing that in two separate promotions, you were part of two big stables. Talk about the balance of that, you know, because usually heel stables, as JR and I are huge fans of, are always good starting points for guys to kind of invigorate their careers or jumpstart their careers. Compare the two stables and how they worked and how you got them going.
Well, all I could really say is that neither one of them were like my original idea. It was, they were given to me and they just told me, this is what we want to happen. In the case of the prophecy, the idea was that first it was me and Simply Luscious, but then it turned into Alice in Danger. And then it was guys that Gabe wanted in that same fold. Like, it started with Donovan Morgan and Xavier and Simply Luscious. And then it turned into Allison. And, but, you know, the idea of these were going to be my guys that were fighting against this code of honor nonsense. And then on the other side, the Triple X thing was never like me and two guys. We were all supposed to be three equal guys. And the mentality with that was, low-key, Elix Skipper and I, we had different deals going on with Japanese companies at the time. And they wanted to have a presence of that faction at TNA every week, even if one of us had to be in Japan. So the idea was, well, when I was in Japan, then it would be Low-Key and Elix. But then when Elix left, I would be back. And, you know, the sort of that interchangeable, the Freebirds mentality of it. Hmm. And then it got to a point about halfway through where Low-Key was very much more involved with, well, first of all, he was very involved with Japan. And then he got injured. And so he was out for a while. So then, you know, Triple X sort of became me and Elix by default at that point. But it was a different mindset. It was never like Triple X was never Christopher Daniels and his two lackeys. It was three guys that were at the same level.
Of course, now early on, too, in TNA, you were a big part of the X division. What did that division mean to you, kind of getting it off the ground and being one of the guys always associated with the early days of that? And of course, being one of the initial champions in the first couple of years as well.
I thought that it was something that hadn't sort of been tapped into yet on the American scene. Like, you know, I talked earlier about how WWF was trying to do a light heavyweight tournament and a division, but I think they always looked at it like these are smaller guys wrestling like heavyweights. They never looked at it like guys that could do different stuff and different style. You know, even when they had like the luchadors there, they sort of gave them, you know, sort of like leftovers in terms of television. They never featured them, I felt, like something that could be different, something that could be an attraction. And I think that was one of the strengths of TNA at that point, because they recognized that they had guys like Low-Key and AJ and Jerry Lynn and Red and Chris Sabin. And then I got thrown into that mix as well. But I mean, these were guys that, you know, our strengths were our agility and our speed. And we all grew up doing some sort of Japanese, you know, either watching or being a part of Japanese wrestling. And so we had that mentality to wrestle that style. And, you know, it was TNA sort of going, all right, you guys know better than we do in terms of this style. Show us the style. And so that's what we did. You know, we went out there and we did what we do rather than what they thought it should be. We showed them what it was and what it could be. And that was why I thought it was so successful. And it became the first thing that TNA had that WWE didn't have. And I think that's always been TNA's strengths, is when they focus on what we aren't, what WWE isn't, instead of what we do just like WWE or similar to WWE. When we do things that WWE doesn't do at all, I think that's when we've had our greatest successes.
I think two more to tap, you know, into that theory with the X division is also the tag division, which is something TNA, I think, has always kind of had the advantage with. And also the knockouts, something that they focused on very heavily for a while there. While WWE was kind of lagging. So I think you're absolutely right, Chris. I think those three are proof positive that when TNA really focuses on what they do better, that's when they're at their best.
Well, yeah, and then a lot of that, too. It's not like a conscious decision sometimes. It sometimes happens on accident, depending on what talent you have there. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, Beer Money was sort of a, well, we don't know what to do with this guy. We don't know what to do with this guy. Let's see what happens. We'll put him here until we figure something out. And then that sort of took a life of its own, and it became something worth focusing on. You know, and then the same thing with the Motor City Machine Guns. Like, that was their idea to get together, Alex Shelley and Chris Sabin. Like, they were sort of languishing as singles guys, but they were, you know, best friends. And they said, well, let's start tagging and let's make something of it. And then all of a sudden you had one of the best tag teams in the world. And all of a sudden, well, let's start focusing on these guys. And I think that's something, too, that's going on with Frankie and myself now. I mean, you know, 2 years ago at the end of 2011, we were sort of, well, we're not quite sure where we're going to go. And Frankie and I got together and said, well, look, there's no more beer money. You know, the Motor City Machine Guns at that point, Saban was injured and they weren't there. I was like, there's a hole here, man. Let's fill it. Let's be a good tag team. Let's be a tag team and get it going. And we went with them. We went to them and said, you know, we'd like to tag. And we were lucky enough to let that they gave us the opportunity. And you know, ever since then, we've been us.
Another thing about another aspect of TNA, Chris, that that WWE never really allowed, it seemed like, is the ability, as you mentioned, when you were in XXX for guys to kind of go to Japan and do some stuff there and then come back kind of freely and move around and do other things. For instance, in 2005, in fact, Justin and I saw you in 2005 at a Ring of Honor show when you took on Matt Hardy. And is that a good hooking point for TNA that say, hey, look, well, you're under contract with us. We want you to work for us. But if you want to go somewhere else, if you want to tour for a little bit, go right ahead. Come right back. We'll work with you on it. Is that a hooking point for TNA to get talent in that they kind of work with you in terms of if you're working in another company and things like that? Is that a good hooking point for TNA to bring guys in?
Well, I think it's just the reality of the situation. I think they knew how deep or how shallow their schedule was going to be. And I think it would have been very short-sighted of them if they were to say, all right, well, we're going to have you sign this contract, but you can't work anywhere else. All right, well, give me my schedule. Well, we're only wrestling one day a week. Do you know what I mean? And that to me would have been very detrimental. I mean, I couldn't have signed a contract if they said, you can't work anywhere else. You're just working for us, but we're only letting you work once a week. So, I mean, they were very open. They knew what they could offer, and they saw that if they worked with guys instead of had that hard line, it's us or nobody mentality, they knew that they were going to grow to be something where they would have full-time positions and full-time schedules, but that wasn't the time. And so they're very, very open in letting us work with our other stuff. And, you know, those of us that were with Ring of Honor at that time, we're very fortunate that the companies sort of had that understanding of working with each other, you know, and not interfering with each other. So we were it was a good hooking point in terms of, it was great for those of us that had that ability to work both companies and sort of, you know, get great matches and get buzz about us. Because I think that was something that benefited TNA and Ring of Honor in that respect, is having that buzz of, hey, this guy's here. If you want to see him live, so Ring of Honor. If you want to see him on TV, he's in TNA, but he's doing great work in both places. And I mean, that to me was a benefit, an added benefit that they got by letting us do that.
So TNA in general, Chris, you know, it's a company that many have buried. Every year you hear, this is the year we're going under, the year they're going under. A lot of people think, you know, one step forward, two back sometimes. But here you are, 11 years later, company's still going strong. The most exposure they've ever had. You guys are out on the road now. Where do you see this company going in the future? I mean... trying to think of the best way to word this without I don't want to trash it because I believe in the promotion. I want to see it continue to develop.
Well, I'll tell you without even asking the question.
Yeah.
I just think, like, you know, if you look at where we've been in the last 3 years, we went from a period of time where we were taping every other week, where we were taping shows on Mondays. They were all taping them on Mondays to show them on Thursdays. We were doing it 1 hour at a time. We were doing 1 hour shows. Then all of a sudden we started getting 2 hours. Then all of a sudden we went live. Now we're out of the building, the home of the company, where we're touring the nation. So, I mean, I think it's a matter of time now where we're going to get to the point where instead of, doing a show every 2 weeks where we show a live show and then tape next week's show in an arena such as the Chicago show we just did or Corpus Christi like last week. I think we're going to get to the point where we're traveling every week and we're doing our live show every week out of these arenas. I think that's the next step. And so, you know, when people talk about the one step forward, one step back, I can see that sometimes. But the truth of the matter is we've been very fortunate in terms of making these small steps forward, whether it was going from the Asylum in Nashville down to Universal Studios in Orlando, going from Fox Sports Net to Spike TV, going from a late night Saturday or whatever we had it Saturday to a Thursday night, going from going into prime time, getting from 1 hour to 2 hours. These have all been steps forward for us, and it's just a matter of time. You have to understand we're 11 years old.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at a company like WWE, when they were 11 years old, where they were, you know, you have to look at the comparisons in that respect. You can't look at the comparisons now and say, well, WWE, that's been firmly entrenched for this long. Mm-hmm. Versus TNA, a company that's been around for 11 years, it's just not a fair comparison. And I think that there are parts of our business that are comparable to them. And I think the one first and foremost is the amount of talent in the roster. But I mean, like the building of the brand and the building of the people's awareness of our product, that's going to take time. And it's just a matter of continue to put a good product on, continue to get as much buzz as you can, continue to make these small steps forward and try to make this company worth watching, get that buzz, get people talking about it. And hopefully, my opinion has always been when people watch our show, whether it's because they hear Hulk Hogan's on it or Jeff Hardy or Kurt Angle, once they see the show in its entirety, once they see the talent that's there, I think that it doesn't take them long to see that this is wrestling the way that it was, you know, the type of wrestling that started, you know, the Monday Night Wars, you know, the type of action in the ring where you're like, well, I got to flip back and forth. I got to watch these guys. I got to see this. And I hope that people are getting that mentality about TNA.
Do you think it was a good idea, Chris, for TNA to go back to go down to what, four pay-per-views a year? I know you just had Lockdown, and you've got Slammiversary coming up June 2nd in Boston. What do you think of the idea of arcing back the pay-per-views for the company?
I think it's good for us. I think right now there's so much. There's so much pay-per-view attractions, and that's not just WWE's 12 a year. But I mean, you look at things like MMA and boxing and other things like that. There's so much pay-per-view money being spent. I would rather us sort of taper down and make the events that we do put out sort of must-see, rather than doing it out of habit, like doing one a month because that's what everyone does. And so far, like I can't tell you like if this experiment has worked yet, because like you said, we've only done the one so far and we've got one coming in June. But I feel like whittling it down to four pay-per-views a year, it gives us the opportunity to make a build towards each one, you know, memorable, and make it to the point where you've got people clamoring to see them. And so I hope that's going to be the end result. I'm not sure how long it's going to take for people to get into that rhythm of thinking to where we've got, you know, 12 weeks to build to each pay-per-view. But, you know, like I said, it's a work in progress, and I think it's something that'll benefit us in the long run.
Another aspect of TNA that I like, and I've noticed over the past few years, that WWE is, I don't want to say given up on, but they don't do as much as they should do, is the concept of the house show. House shows were always the backbone of companies in the 80s and 90s, early 90s. WWE's house show business is, I don't know, mediocre at best, probably. I think you guys do a great job. I live here, Justin and I both live here in the Northeast, and the last 3 years, you guys have done a big show out in Brooklyn at now it's MCU Park, where the Cyclones play. 4th right. of July area, you guys come in for an awesome show. I've not had a chance to attend one yet. I hope to attend the one this year. I haven't seen it on the site yet that you guys have started promoting it yet. I definitely want to go. But it seems like you guys really take advantage of the live shows, even the ones not televised. Talk about that. What's the hook with – why is TNA so focused on the house show business that maybe WWE is kind of – I won't say given up on, but definitely not succeeded like they used to.
Well, I think it's because we're still sort of at the stage where we can get to be more intimate with our house show crowd. You know, there's going to be a time where we're going to be able to fill you know, the big arenas that WWE fills. But at this point where we're not, I think we try and fashion the show to fit the audience that we have. And so because we've got, you know, we're trying to build these audiences in all these different markets, you know, and try and build up and get more and more each time. At this point, though, we have the ability to sort of reward those people that are supporting us by giving them a very interactive show. And I mean, you know, the meet and greets and the things we've done in the past where, you know, fans have gotten a chance to meet with the wrestlers and get that interaction with us that you may not have with the WWF. I mean, you know, you look at WWF or WWE and they're, you know, they're this multi-million dollar corporation. And when they do these things like Access, you know, it's like Grand Central Station. And I mean, so you don't, you know, these guys that are doing it, they don't necessarily get a chance to interact with the fans. And that's tough for fans sometimes, you know, they get disappointed. They get a chance to interact with their favorite wrestlers. Hopefully the stuff that we're doing with TNA, we're giving these people that are supporting us a reason to be happy to that they've supported us, a sort of a reward for their support.
So not even looking at the business aspect of it, but even just the quality of program part of it, do you think getting out of the Impact Zone and out on the road was a strong positive quality wise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as good as that crowd was, you know, we were fighting the law of diminishing returns. We were there for 7 years. They watched us, you know, every week, every other week for that long. And I mean, it got to a point where they, you know, they had seen all just about everything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, now we're getting an opportunity to be new every week to a different crowd. And I think that it's definitely something that's going to benefit us in the long run. It's just a matter of people getting used to that idea now of we're in a different town every week, you know, doing our television different places every week. But I mean, you know, I always say that the best way to experience professional wrestling is live. And what we're doing is we're getting that live atmosphere in these bigger buildings, but we're also televising it. We're getting it televised so that the audience at home sort of sees the electricity of that live audience. And because, you know, Orlando had sort of become numb to that electricity, it wasn't translating as well on television as the shows in Chicago, the shows in Jonesboro, Arkansas, the show we just did in Corpus Christi. I think that had a much better atmosphere, at least watching it on television. It felt like you were watching an event. And I think that's the sort of thing that we need to get everybody excited about this, our product, excited about our television show. And that's going to be a way that we can do it.
And I agree. I think a part of it was that the fans there, and you don't have to comment or disagree or agree on this, but the fans there seem to start, it's actually been going on for a while, feels like, just making themselves the show. And to me, when that happens, and this is how I felt ECW was, and even Ring of Honor for a little bit. But when the fans try and make themselves the show, to me, is when it really takes away from it. And
right.
I don't want to say rebelling, because, you know, fans can do what they want. But I just hate that mentality of they got to get their chance in. They got to get the atmosphere in that they want. And to me, that's what really detracts. And I think it was a great move to get out of there, just for even if it's just for a while, or you can go back every now and then. But I think it was just good to get out on the road and just get some fresh blood out in the stands.
Yeah. Yeah, so far, like we've been very, very happy. We've literally, it feels like forever, but we've only done three so far.
Mm-hmm.
Those three houses that I told you about, but just the excitement and seeing that we can put that many people in these size arenas, you know, hopefully we continue to do that as this goes on.
I blog the show, Chris, on our message board, so I've been watching all three live. I've actually been watching since. For a while, but definitely since you've gone live, and all three crowds, Chicago, Jonesboro, particularly the show, the crowd 2 weeks ago in Corpus Christi, red hot. They were smoking. And
yeah,
obviously
yeah.
you guys, what's great about it is you're booking these live shows as if they're pay-per-views. I mean, you had the Full Metal Mayhem match with Bully Ray and Jeff. You had the tag title match. You came out with in the storyline with AJ and Hogan and I mean, that was great. You guys, that threw me off. I was stoked when you and Kaz came out, because I was totally thrown off by that. That was awesome. I love the angle that is. I love the angle that's been, where you guys kind of throw like a third wrench in the mix with the whole "where's AJ going" kind of thing. That was great. I love that.
Thank you.
You talked about like Access, like like WWE does for their WrestleMania weekend. You guys had a huge weekend in San Antonio for a lockdown.
Right.
How did that go? Just give us a little kind of summary that this first huge weekend, the first kind of pay-per-view that stood alone. How did it go? How did it feel like the whole weekend with the fans and setting up for the big show? Tell us about it.
Well, I'll tell you this. Anytime we've ever done pay-per-views outside of Orlando, they've been special events. So, I mean, lockdown was a special event, but it wasn't the first one of its kind. Like I remember last year when we did Slammiversary in Arlington, that we make it sort of a weekend of it. I mean, and it's something that, you know, again, goes back to giving back to the fans, giving that opportunity to interact with us. And, you know, lockdown was another great, great weekend in that respect. We had, you know, events where the fans got a chance to come out and do meet and greets and interact with us. And then, you know, culminating in the big show and lockdown was our most attended event that we've had. And, you know, I look to that now that we're whittling down to the four a year. I hope that it's going to get to the point where because we only have four, not only is it more highly anticipated, but they're going to be higher attendance and make each one of those weekends, if we're going to do the interactions, the fan interaction, things like that. Hopefully those are going to have more people at it as well and just continue to build up and continue that forward momentum.
So let's dip back just a couple years here, Chris, and tell us how Curry Man made his way back into your life and this time in TNA.
Well, it was I sort of was at a crossroads in terms of character. I had gone to people in the office and said I wanted to do more. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to be more involved. And they said, well, give us something to involve you. And I sort of took a look at how I was doing with the Fallen Angel character. And I realized that I was sort of wearing another man's clothes playing that character. It was, you know, I always had visions of the Fallen Angel character being, you know, this leader of men, this guy that was a mouthpiece, but also a guy who, you know, had such very heavy religious overtones that I thought if it was played in a certain way would get a great reaction. But I also, you know, I finally sort of realized that me playing that character, A, it wasn't something that our company sort of wanted to embrace and push the limits and push the envelope with. And B, if you weren't going to push the envelope with it, it sort of sounded sort of put on, like it wasn't coming naturally from me. And so I went with them and I said, well, let me do two things then. You guys have always, like TNA had always said, why are you the Fallen Angel? Why are you called the Fallen Angel? And I always was answering them with this, well, with this heavy pseudo-religious thing. And finally, I said, okay, well, look, if that's a problem, let's do this. You guys think that my strength is my wrestling. Let me just be the Fallen Angel because I'm the Fallen Angel. I used to be a good guy. Now I'm a bad guy. You know, Shawn Michaels doesn't literally break hearts every time he walks in the ring. So let the name just be the name and let's concentrate on Christopher Daniels. Or let me do this. And I told them about Curry Man. And I said, this is what I was. And I could do this and blah, blah, blah. And they were interested in that. And so, but the thing about it is the difference that I had to do when I was in New Japan and Michinoku, Curry Man was a character that was a character until he got in the ring and then he wrestled. And, you know, the thing that made me stand out was the presentation of Curry Man in Japan. But, you know, when I was in the wrestling ring with guys like Tiger Mask and Jushin Liger, and all of the best of New Japan's junior heavyweights, you know, I stood toe-to-toe with them as far as wrestling, and that was what made me stand out. I knew that here in TNA, that wasn't going to be the best use of my thing, and so this became more of an entertainment thing, more of a character-driven thing. And so when they got interested in it, and, you know, they wanted me to change the look of the character, the costume of the character up, I decided to go like a couple steps beyond what I had been doing in Japan and make it more, not specifically a comedy character, but definitely more entertaining. You know, working on, you know, when I got there, doing the dance a little bit more, working on my voice, being, you know, the broken Japanese, which turned into broken English. And, you know, and then they saw some good interaction between me and Shark Boy, and then also with me and Eric Young, and they decided to put the three of us together and, you know, decided to make something out of that. So that was how that all came around. And, you know, I'm sorry that it went away so quickly. I thought it had a lot longer legs than it did, but, you know, that was their decision. And finally, when I left and when Curryman went back to Japan, where he now works in Kinko's, in Morioka, you know, it just opened the door for me to come back as myself. And it was a good lesson for me. It was a good year of not putting so much emphasis on, you know, again, like I said, getting away from the, I'm a good wrestler, you know, that straight ahead, nose to the grindstone, just a wrestler thing. You know, it was remembering that, hey, these people are here to be entertained as well. It doesn't always have to be with, you know, German half suplexes and stuff.
So before we wrap up the wrestling portion of this, I just had a question about someone that you've had, you spent some time with both, actually in all three places, really, WWF, you ran into him in WCW, and again with TNA, and that's Vince Russo, a very divisive character in wrestling history. We mentioned him briefly when you're talking about WCW. What are your thoughts of Vince, his booking style and his effect on the companies you've been part of with him?
Well, the truth of the matter is, like, I'm sort of hot and cold on Vince. You know, there were times when Vince gave me the opportunity, and there were times where Vince had what I thought was a very closed vision of what I could do. And, you know, I think sometimes the worst thing I could say about Vince is that sometimes he never wanted to take, like, he was always happy to take credit, but he never necessarily wanted to take blame when things weren't going very well. And there was a period of time where he basically told me that I wasn't working because I wasn't connecting with the crowd. But part of that to me was the presentation of me. Like, there's only so much I can do. The only thing I can affect when I get into the ring is how I wrestle in the ring. But I mean, the way I was being presented and the way that I was being given to the fans, that was all, you know, Vince and his writing and his stuff. And I give it to you like this. I could be the best tasting steak in the world, but if I put it to you on a garbage can lid, are you going to eat it? You know what I mean?
Yep.
There were periods of time where, like, and I think a lot of the problems that I had with Vince was when I would ask him why we were doing things, and he was frustrated with me that I would question him rather than looking at my questions as a way to try to get the best presentation involved. Like, one thing that, for example, there was a period of time, there was a television episode where I came in and I interrupted the Motor City Machine Guns in an interview, and I said, guys, we got to stand together. You know, this was when the World Elite was going on. We got to stand together because the World Elite's coming together. You know, stand with me and let's fight. And as I walk away, you know, the guns sort of look at me like, oh, well, this fucking guy, this clown, blah, blah, blah. And so basically undermining me. But I mean, to me, that just showed the fans that, well, they're not on my side. Why should you then be on my side? And then it made me look stupid to go out there and think that these guys were in my corner watching my back as I wrestled a guy with two guys on the floor in his corner. And I ended up losing. And I thought, well, all you did was made me look like an idiot. And I'm supposed to be the good guy. The good guys aren't supposed to be the idiots. The good guys are supposed to be the sympathetic characters. And if you go out there and you make your good guys look like idiots, why do you want to support them? And so, but that wasn't me. That was Vince's idea. Oh, well, we're going to, you know, it'll be funny if the Motor Machine Guns sort of talk junk on you once you walk away. Okay, well, that's good for them. But what you've done is you undermined me. And then, you know, he'll come to me later and say, well, that didn't work. Well, whose fault is that? I didn't write it. All I did was wrestle the match. So, I mean, that's, you know, there were times where Vince had really good ideas, but there were also times where Vince thought his ideas were so good that having them questioned and trying to be worked on, you know, it wasn't on his list of things to do. And so that was the most disappointing thing to me as far as working with Vince, was sometimes trying to get sort of a collaboration going was very hard work.
Do you think they hung on to him too long there? Dixie seemed to have some kind of relationship or feeling for Vince, and it seemed like, yeah, every time it seemed about time for him to go, you'd hear, okay, he's been reassigned, or that they're going to go with it a little bit longer. Do you think he set the company back a little bit in the fact that they should have maybe moved on a little sooner?
I don't know. I appreciate that Dixie had loyalty to him, mm-hmm. and I know that like when things were going well, or then when things went well, you know, I think sometimes he also took blame for things that weren't necessarily his problem too. But sometimes there felt like there was a lot of, I don't know. It's hard to say that he was the reason, or he was the main reason, or the only reason, where things went bad or good. So I just think it worked out the way it worked out. And, you know, to say, could it have been different? It's just speculation, you know?
All right. Well, that was, we're going to switch gears a little bit now. We've talked a boatload of wrestling, and TNA is going strong, and we continue to watch, and you and Kaz are awesome. But
I agree, we are awesome.
Yeah, of course you are.
Of course
you are a bad influence, but you are awesome. Yes. We're going to talk about your other love besides, of course, theater and wrestling, and that is comic books. You wore an awesome T-shirt. I can't remember what episode it was. Probably about it was 3 weeks ago. I'm a John Byrne guy. Love that.
Oh, that was 2 weeks ago. That was 2 weeks ago. That was Corpus Christi. Yeah, the pay-per-view.
Yep, that was when you guys came out. Yeah,
that's
yep.
right.
When did you start collecting? As a kid?
Yeah, definitely. Like way before. Like I knew I collected them even before I remembered what I was collecting. So I'd want to say like 9, 10 years old. But the first stuff I remember actually collecting and like with the mindset of keep getting this every month was Claremont and Burns X-Men. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, that was the thing that got me in it, and got me in it for good. And so that was, God, what was that, 83?
Yeah.
So ever since then,
Why X-Men? Why in particular? I mean, of all the Marvel titles?
I don't know. I wish I could tell you. I remember picking it up and you know, really liking the art. I was a big fan of John Byrne, and you know, the two friends I had in school that collected books, we all got into it and was passing it around, and we knew that there was a little bit of buzz going on it, but why? And I couldn't tell you. I just it was good. It was different. The idea of the heroes that were sort of not heroes. They weren't like Superman, where everybody like adored and trusted them. They were, you know, different from everyone else. And, you know, the thing that Claremont did so well, he sort of played the aspect of the fact that they were different. And mm-hmm. despite the fact that they were different and not necessarily beloved by humanity, they still did what they thought was right. And, you know, protected not just themselves being human beings and mutants, but also humanity as a whole, whether all of them loved them or not. So
what'd you think of the movies?
I was okay with the movies. I understood that, you know, when you try and condense what is anywhere from 100 to 300 to 500 issues of comic continuity into a 2-hour movie, changes are going to get made, and you're playing to do different audiences. You're playing to the audiences that are super familiar with the characters and have a love of the characters already, and then you also want to talk to the fans or the people that have no clue who the X-Men are. And so, you know, there are different things that were different in the movies that were different or different in the movies than there were in the comic books. And none of them really jumped out at me so much that made me go, well, this is crap. Like there are times in movies where you go, all right, well, that doesn't jibe. Like the one I always talk about in terms of like examples of that, like in the Daredevil movie, when Daredevil sort of lets the guy get hit by the train, I was like, well, that's not Daredevil. That doesn't sort of jive. Right. So I don't really buy that. But like, you know, in the first movie, making sort of putting Rogue in the spot where Kitty Pryde was in the comic books, that to me was okay, because, you know, it was a way to get Rogue involved, but still sort of have the relationship with Wolverine. Like that didn't make me go, oh, I shan't watch this another second, you know. I sort of understood it. And then like the big argument, not the argument, but like the big like for the First Class movie that just came out, everybody was mm-hmm. like, well, wait a minute, this is completely not right, because it's not Cyclops, Marvel Girl, Iceman, Angel, Beast. And I was like, okay, I'll buy that. But at the same mm-hmm. time, the movie that did come out, it paid homage to Bryan Singer's stuff, and it told a story that was very close to what Marvel might have put together if it was their decision to do it that way. So that, to me, was still entertaining. It still had ties in the characters that I knew and liked. And so, yeah, I haven't had any problems with any of them.
So as we're on the comic stuff, I guess this is a good time to bring up our mutual friend and, of course, longtime listener. And I don't want to not mention his name, because we're going to have to deal with him ranting and raving on Twitter. He calls me out enough for shit I say on the show, and that is, of course, Ben Morse.
The human highlight reel, Ben Morse. Yes.
Anything specific you want to say to Ben while you have this open forum here that you can directly deride him?
I usually like to deride him just face-to-face, but I will say this. Ben has been a very devoted pal, and for all the junk that I give him and his tag team partner, Arun Singh, especially when we go into Comic Conflict, the pay-per-view event happening at the San Diego Comic-Con this year, where Frankie and Kazarian and myself will battle them in a test of will. Ben's been great, man. Ben is awesome in terms of, like, you know, keeping me involved with comics. And, you know, he's one of the first guys that helped me sort of transition into getting into the iPad and the digital world as far as comic books. And he knows my love for variant covers. He knows I'm horrible in terms of wanting to get all the variant covers and all the hard to get stuff. So he's always feeding me my fix. So I can't bury him too much, but I will say that I think in terms of our wrestling skill, Bad Influence has the comic book guys beat. Despite how big Arun Singh is, the bag of muscles.
So when's the showdown? You said July?
It's up to Ben and Arun, because they're so busy at San Diego Comic-Con, but they've challenged us to a match somewhere, some form. So you'll have to get Ben on the podcast and chat with him about it.
I was saying, we might have to have you both on face-to-face to promote this thing, and then you guys
can... That's fine with me. We're already in a Twitter war, so...
Okay, yeah, we'll take it public.
Get it on the podcast world as well.
Oh, no doubt. Excellent. We will definitely talk to Ben. We'll get that set up. I think that'll be pretty good. Scott and I can judge the winner, and then, of course, it'll be you, and there's no doubt about that.
Yep, of course it will be.
But of course.
All right, Chris, before we do have some listener questions, but I just wanted to ask you one more question back in the wrestling world. Where would you like to see the wrestling business go if you could decide? If you had the all, you know, even above Vince McMahon power, above Dixie Carter power, and you could dictate, this is the direction I'd love to see wrestling go. Do you have anything in mind of what you'd like to see?
Do you mean changes? I mean, I'd like wrestling to get as popular as it was back in the early 2000s. I'd love to say that wrestling would be able to, grow their television fan base back to where it was and translate that into people buying for the pay-per-views. How do we do that? I wish I knew that. If I knew that, I'd bottle it and sell it. But, I think there's a reason that wrestling has been, so firmly entrenched in the culture of America. And, despite the fact of, despite the popularity of things like mixed martial arts now and the fighting sports, wrestling is still very popular. And, there's a reason for that. I mean, the differences between MMA and pro wrestling are enough where there's fans of both. And there are people that love one and hate the other. And I think, if there's a way that pro wrestling can sort of recapitalize on its lost popularity, I'd love to see that happen.
Do you think MMA has long-term appeal? Will it last?
It depends, man. I think because of the nature of the beast, the careers of the fighters are shorter. If you can name the fighters that are actual draws, it's a short number. It's a short list. And I mean, will UFC get to the point where just the name UFC sells and you don't need any names on it? That's an argument to be made. Like at this point right now, WrestleMania sells itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I mean, at the same time, you still have wrestlers that are on it. Guys like John Cena, guys like CM Punk, that are the proven commodities. UFC's job is going to be find fighters that become their John Cena, their Rock, their CM Punk, their Undertaker. But, you know, are you going to see a UFC fighter with a career like the Undertaker's longevity wise? That's, it's hard to say. I my first instinct, because of the wear and tear of just the training itself, shortens the career. So, I mean, I don't know, man. It's hard to tell. And this is coming from a complete neophyte when it comes to UFC. Mixed martial arts. I don't watch. I know the names, but I couldn't tell you. You know, I don't have an appreciation of the art form like a lot of my friends do. And so.
All right. So we have a few listener questions here. I think some of these we've touched upon. I'm going to just ask them because they took the time to post them. But if there's anything you want to add, feel free. If not, we can just move right along.
Okay.
First one just says the contrast to having the darker persona, Fallen Angel versus Curry Man, more comedic. Do you prefer one or the other?
I don't prefer. I like being able to do both and work. I think that it shows a range. And, you know, I sort of have taken the best of both worlds now as what I'm doing now. You know, I'm very fun loving and very, you know, quick with a joke or a light of your smoke as I am now. But I also feel like I can turn the corner and become a threat and become very violent in this, you know, what I'm doing now. So I feel like, you know, I don't have a preference either way. I like to have the range to be able to do both.
All right. Next question was, you're talking about comic book influences. Do you ever, any influences with the character, whether it be this current character or when you were the Fallen Angel, did you get any influences from comic characters?
Not specifically for this character or the dark character, but I will say that one of the things that I've, found that works in terms of being a villain in that respect is I've always been a fan of the villains who thought they were right, who had the mentality that they were in the right and the world was the one that was wrong. Those are the guys that I believed in terms of being like actual, you know, guys that were just villains for the sake of bad, you know, the let's do this because it's evil. That to me was very shallow. But I mean, you look at someone like Magneto who had a cause to fight for and he had reasons to do what he's doing. I mean, and you can even tie it into what's going on now with Cyclops and the X-Men. Like he's sort of become a villain, but at the same time, he hasn't changed his beliefs. He's just changed what he's done or what he's willing to do to further his beliefs. So that to me, it makes him one of the most interesting characters in the comics now. And I feel like if I as a wrestler can get my convictions across as strongly as that, then I become a compelling character to watch.
Do you feel that your current character with Bad Influence is closer to your true personality?
Yes, absolutely. 1,000%. Basically, what you see me and Frankie do on television is what we do behind the scenes, what we do as we travel, just snarky, smartass, you know, wise guys.
Martini That's drinking?
Us. Absolutely. Absolutely. One a day keeps the doctor away.
Very nice.
Excellent. Is there any indie star that you feel would be bigger than they became?
Ooh, can you, in what respect? Do you mean like someone that's on the verge of being discovered or someone that never made it as far as he should have? Like, what do you mean?
Never made it as far as he should have.
I'm... Like Reckless Youth comes to mind. Like I thought Reckless Youth was a great guy, a great wrestler, and you know, just some bad breaks in terms of health, you know, sort of going farther along. There was a period of time where he was starting to break out in Ring of Honor, and then I want to say he had injury that sort of took him out and then sort of got away from it. That's the only one I can think of like that.
Just to flip it, anyone you didn't really see much in that exceeded expectations?
I'll say this, I'll say this about Kurt Angle. He surprised me because when I first met him, he was a very serious guy in terms of he took himself very seriously. You know, he was coming out of the Olympics and excuse me, when I met him in the dojos, he was very driven, very serious. And sort of being that Olympic level athlete in the wrestling ring. And I didn't think, you know, when I looked at him there, and then you see what he did in the WWE, and you see what he's done in TNA, like, you didn't see that personality until then. And I, you know, I didn't see it, and I had no idea that he was that much of a personality when I first met him. So, like, Kurt Angle definitely was a big surprise to, I think, everybody.
All right, final question that may or may not have come from me. Has Dennis Stamp ever refereed one of your matches? And if not, when do you think that phone will next ring for him?
I think he was teaching a trampoline class the day he was to ref one of mine. So no, I have not. But I understand that Dennis Stamp is coming back somewhere. I want to say Chikara, maybe. I read somewhere that Dennis Stamp is appearing somewhere. Because he is booked, so maybe the dumbbells and the trampoline have gone back in the shed because he is booked at this time.
Yeah, he is. He's making a comeback. He hit Facebook with a vengeance, and we're trying to get him. We're trying to get him on the show. He's a big,
good luck with him.
Big staple.
I hope he comes out.
I hope so too. I got Kevin Kelly on the case, private detective. So
excellent.
All right, Chris, we want to thank you. This was awesome. We had a blast. Just chatting some wrestling with you, and if you don't mind, actually hang on the line. We have one last quick question for you after we wrap up here. But we will love to have you back on. You and Ben will promote the fight coming up if you'd be willing to come back.
Yep, and yep. We'll also promote that TNA is continuing to be live. You guys are in what, Tampa soon?
Pittsburgh now this week, right? You said
this week we're in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and then two weeks in May we're in Tampa. Mm-hmm. I want to say we're in Tulsa, Oklahoma soon as well. So if you go to impactwrestling.com, though, the full list of cities is there.
Yeah, and of course Slammiversary coming up on June 2nd from Boston, and then hopefully we'll see you, Chris. I'll have to point us out because I definitely would like to go to the show in Brooklyn if you guys come back to Coney Island in 4th of July. Again, I haven't seen that show on the site yet. I know it's a little bit out, but we hopefully you guys come back because you've definitely had a good business. So hope to see you back in Brooklyn again. So
sure, man. Sure, I think that that's usually a staple of our summer. So I'm sure it'll be a base brawl show that we'll be out there soon for.
Absolutely.
All right, PTB Nation, we will be right back and take a Chris break. A quick break, and that, of course, is Christopher Daniels. We'll be right back to wrap up.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Barf.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get y'all until I get you, Paul Jones. Ooh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunder Lips, I was winning world titles.
So a guy from across the pond and a dude from the South, Where the Big Boys Play. It's a great podcast. Harv and Chad are awesome. Check them out. Also check out WrestleChat.net, indeed where it's at. Great message board, plenty of topics to browse, the Still Real to Us podcast, and much, much more. Also, our message board, which is awesome, bigelow34.proboards.com. It's where PTB really began. Written reviews and a boatload of them. In PTB Nation, we have you to thank for that. Plus the territory wars, a whole lot more. If you want a one-touch spot for our show, you can head there. Also head to Stitcher.com and the Stitcher app for all phones and tablets, and more details on that. Also, our good friend Graham Cawthon, historyofwwe.com, the best research site you will ever find. Also, another sponsor to the show, the Wrestling Forum, twfnews.com, their wrestling forum, a blog site, and much, much more. The guys at TWF creating a wrestling media nation, many blogs, podcasts, and vodcasts. Yours could be included in the official forum of WrestleChat.net and the place to be. We've joined up as well. So check them out, find out what they're about at twfnews.com. Also, you can check out
our show at GetThePointRadio.com. My good friend Mike, it's a great online radio station. If you're not in the mood for wrestling, but you want to listen to music, pop it on. He plays music all day long. But you can also check his archive on iTunes, and all of our shows are there as well. Big site.
Hey, this is Scott Hudson, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast with Scott and Justin.
Fourth pack is back, goes on mass destruction. Guess who's here? The bad boys are wrestling. Testing competition when the war does the mission. Not no mercy, see the race like the street. If you don't know, you better find out the Wolf Pack. It'll prove a point. Number one, just believe that you don't want to test it with them. I'll be there for them. Coming to rain with them, you never walk.
All right, Nation, welcome back. We really hope you enjoyed that interview with Christopher Daniels. Really interesting stuff and a very compelling speaker. And just another one to our catalog of great interviews, Scott.
Yeah, he was awesome. I mean, a guy, again, who's had such a fantastic career in the business. And he was so informative, and his love of comic books is great. Very unique guest. One of our more unique ones that we've had in our 214 episodes. So,
yeah, very open, which is cool.
Yeah, no, it was very good. So we thank the Fallen Angel and the Curry Man, Christopher Daniels, for joining us.
And Nation, now, as we move past Christopher Daniels and kind of set you up for the next couple weeks, you know, if there's nothing else about the Place to Be podcast, you always know that we're all about tradition.
Yes.
We like our holiday episodes. We like our anniversary episodes. And we like our contests.
And guess what's coming back?
Yeah, as I teased a couple weeks ago on the Facebook page, the PTB second annual trivia contest is drawing near.
Yes, it is. And of course, the big question, can Jay Hinchy successfully defend his championship? Can Dave Hall get redemption?
Maybe.
For last year's loss. And will Jay Arsenio D'Amato not embarrass himself again? And can anybody do better than Josh Richer?
Probably not. So Wednesday night, after Backlash 1999 review, we will give you all the details. We're going to run through the rules for the first time for you all. We have very specific rules. And I'm going to announce the opening of a thread. That thread will be posted on the Bigelow34.proboards.com message board. And the trivia contest entry is going to be first come, first serve. Our plan is to have 24 entries. Jay Hinchy and Dave Hall are grandfathered in because they made the finals last year. Yep. So there's 22 open spots. Now, if we go past 24 total and get to 32, we're going to expand to 32. That will be the max, though. We will not be doing more than 32.
No.
So that is the goal. If we get 30 additional people on top of Hinchy and Hall, we'll go to 32. I will announce on Wednesday when that thread will be posted. There is no favorites. I don't care how long you've been listening to the show, how big of a fan you are. It'll be first come, first serve. No guaranteed spot. So I'm going to give you a time. It'll be plenty of time for people to hear this show and read the Facebook page and everything else. It'll probably be over the weekend sometime. That we will be posting that thread for you to sign up for the trivia contest. And again, Wednesday night we'll go over the rules and we'll give you that entry time as well. So with that said, Scott, why don't we go ahead and wrap up. Hope everyone enjoyed this interview. That's Scott Griscola. I'm Justin Rosero. That was Christopher Daniels. Everyone, we'll come back and we'll speak to you Wednesday night from my home, Providence, Rhode Island. Backlash 99. Take care.
When you weren't at.
Yeah, I wasn't at. But still, it's kind of cool.
Over here, there.